He was a man who was described as short of stature, with a black beard, a piercing eye, broad shoulders, and a stout heart. That's John Knox, the father of Scottish liberty. He was known as the Thundering Scot. That's a label. It is said that he took a text, announced it, began with it, warmed to it, and then proceeded to flail the pulpit with it. We are told that sometimes they had to replace the surface of the pulpit, so thoroughly had it been worked over by this preacher. Scotland, the 16th century, a nation, the northern half of the main island, which was ancient Britain in the days of the Roman Empire. Some of you remember, some few of you remember, a Roman emperor, Hadrian, who built a wall across the middle of that island to separate the Scots in the north from the Britons in the south. Bad blood between the two for centuries. The Scots look upon the English as sophisticated snobs. The English looked upon the Scots as barbarians, and they enjoyed no fellowship with one another. Scotland was a priest-ridden country. It was dominated by the church, controlled the state, although there was a king. He was inferior to the church. The cardinal, Cardinal Beaton, B-E-A-T-O-N, at St. Andrew's Castle, was the real, practical ruler of the land. For a few minutes this afternoon, I want you to exercise your imagination and be willing to accept for a few minutes the absurd fact that I am John Knox. Absurd fact. It's not a fact. We're going to assume it's a fact. John Knox, born at the beginning of the 16th century. The date is uncertain, and I don't remember it. The biographers say it was sometime between 1505 and 1514. The only certain knowledge of his early years, of my early years, was my matriculation at St. Andrew's University on the way to becoming a priest. Little is known of my family, but I was a Scot. If you visit my country today and ask to find my grave in the parking lot behind the church where I preached, an attendant will point to some lined parking places where these amazing vehicles you came in, hard, round, rubber wheels, no place to attach the horses, where those vehicles would park today. He would point to a certain one, and he would point to the position of the left rear wheel in the vehicle parked in that spot. And he would say, "We believe somewhere under that wheel is where John Knox was buried." Sic transit gloriam. Today, Scotland's capital, Edinburgh, is two cities in one, joined by a modern bridge. There's the old city up on high, and a deep ravine separating it from the modern new city down below. I lived eventually in the upper, the old city. That city, that upper city, is mainly one long, mile-long street. It's called High Street, H-I-G-H, because it's in the high part. At one end of High Street is the castle, Edinburgh Castle, perched upon rocky ledge, invincible, unassailable. A mile away, at the other end of the same High Street, is the palace, Holyrood Palace, Palace of the Holy Blood, where the queen or the king resided. Halfway between, in the middle of the High Street, half-mile mark, is St. Giles Church. That was eventually to become my pulpit. And the church is so situated that the pulpit, standing in the pulpit, one faces the palace at the end of the street. That proved to be significant. In 1524, a young man in his 20s went from Scotland to Wittenberg, Germany, the University of Wittenberg, to sit under the lectures of Martin Luther, who by then, 1524, 3 years after the Diet at Worms, was well known throughout Europe. He drank, Patrick Hamilton was his name, he drank at the feet, as it were, at the fount of the Reformed doctrine of Martin Luther. He came back to Scotland and preached what he had learned. He was burned at the stake by Cardinal Beaton. In his 20s, this was the reaction to the message of the gospel preached in that land. A decade or more later, I became a priest at St. Andrews University, intending to serve the church, but in the process of training to become a priest, I came to know the God whose Son is the only priest between man, the only mediator between man and God. I came to embrace the gospel of Jesus Christ. My contemporary was George Wishart. He preached that gospel. He was burned by Cardinal Beaton. I was his friend. I was his protector. I carried a two-handled claymore, a sword. I was ready, like Peter in the garden, to protect my friend. And George Wishart said, "No, John, one is enough for one sacrifice. You remain and labor still." That was my marching orders. Soon, the nobility of Scotland at St. Andrews stormed the castle of Lord Beaton, Cardinal Beaton, and hanged the cardinal. He, the cardinal, had lolled on a divan in the window above the courtyard where Wishart was burned, enjoyed the spectacle, and the nobility were said to have declared at that time, "Cardinal, one day soon another sight shall be witnessed from that window." They stormed the castle and they hanged Cardinal Beaton from that very window. We will not compliment the action, except to observe that it well reflects the growing disdain that the people had toward the dominant church in a day when change was in the wind on the continent and soon now to come to my Scotland. It was later said to Cardinal Beaton, of Cardinal Beaton, if you must burn heretics, burn them in the cellar, for the smoke of Hamilton's burning has infected all on whom it blew. The nobility were infected by the smoke of Hamilton's burning, and they took out that infection by attacking its source. Burnings were held in public as public spectacles and public illustrations, warnings to the public against embracing heresy as Rome defined it. I was invited to become chaplain to these nobility who had taken St. Andrew's Castle. I was young in the faith. I joined them. Soon, Scotland's friend, France, came to the aid of the Scottish Church of Rome. They took back the castle, took us into captivity, and I, John Knox, joined the others as a galley slave on a French ship for a total of 19 months. Through the heat of one summer and the cold of two winters, I was chained to the oarlocks of a French ship and forced to row as its propulsion. They regularly brought to us a painted image, a wooden image of the Virgin Mary, and required that we, chained to the oarlocks, kiss the image as it was passed among us, deliberately insulting our conscious faith. When it came to me, with the degree of liberty that the chains permitted me, I took the image and tossed her overboard into the sea. I said, let Our Lady swim. She is more fit to swim than to be worshipped. They did not repeat that demand. But in response to my action, I was lashed, bare-backed, face downward, head downward on a slanted board, and whipped until blood flowed in my back. Within 19 months, the English came to our rescue, arranged a truce, we were released, and in gratitude, I went to the border of England and there became a pastor in Berwick, England. Until, this was because on the throne of England at the time was Edward VI, the boy king, the godly young man, reared spiritually by the influence of Thomas Cranmer, and I believe someone we will meet in heaven. Young man, tubercular, weak in body, strong in spirit, and dead before he had ended his teens, but on the throne during his early teens. Son, the only son to the infamous Henry VIII, who had two half-sisters, each by a different mother, the elder of whom was Mary, whom you know as Bloody Mary, the younger being Elizabeth. As long as he was on the throne, we had a degree of liberty as a gospel preacher on the border between England and Scotland. He died and was succeeded by his sister Bloody Mary, whose bloodiness was quickly demonstrated by her insisting that all re-embrace the teachings of Rome. It was obvious that I was either going to become a martyr under Mary or an exile under Mary. I preferred the latter to the former. So, voluntarily left England, went to the continent. First went to Frankfurt in Germany, and then found my way to Geneva, where John Calvin had recently begun a model, a paragon of a Christian community. It was a place of remarkable prosperity and peace. There were rules, there were laws adopted by the city council, not imposed by the clergy, and surely not by John Calvin. The city council adopted the requirement that every minister in the city preach only from the Word of God. He had to use the Bible as the source of his text without exception. There were social rules for the community. There was a curfew at 9 o'clock on the assumption that nothing good happens out in the public after 9 p.m. It's 11 o'clock, you know where your children are, was a refrain in my youth, at least. You could not marry a wife without her being approved by the city council. And conversely, you could not marry a husband without his being approved by the city council. You could not hire a domestic servant without the council's approval. It was a place of spiritual liberty. People flocked to it who had an affinity for it. There was no demand that you live in Geneva. You were not forced to live. You could move away if you didn't like it. The assumption was not that an external moral environment will make you a Christian, but rather that a Christian will prefer a strongly moral, upright environment for the assistance in living a godly life. And the city more than doubled in its size during the time of Calvin. I was given the privilege in Geneva during these few years of being the Bible teacher. The Reformed position of Calvin was that there were four ecclesiastical offices. There was pastor, there was teacher, there was elder, and there was deacon. And we tend to elide the two, pastor and teacher. But teacher was a separate, not a school teacher, but a Bible teacher. And weekdays during the year, people who could attended in the chapel, today known as the Knox Chapel, teaching of the Scriptures. And on the Lord's Day was the exhortation and the exposition of the Scriptures in the messages from the pulpit. I became the Bible teacher in Geneva. Learned much, saw the operation of the Reformed doctrine and Presbyterian polity, which had been developed in the city of Geneva under John Calvin. Soon later, the opportunity came to return to my own country. In my own country, a little bit of history is necessary here. The father of Henry VIII, who was Henry VII in England, had a daughter as well as the famous son, Henry, who became Henry VIII. He, the father, wished to create a friendship and end the long animosity between England and Scotland by marrying his daughter to the King of Scotland, creating a marriage alliance that he hoped would cement friendliness between two nations. It did not work. In resentment of this effort to buy our friendship with a princess, the son of that marriage, of Mary to James the IV of Scotland, was James the V of Scotland, and he deliberately married a French princess to smack in the face the English effort to win Scottish friendship. England and France were enemies. They had been enemies for centuries. A 100 years' war had been fought between the two countries, which lasted 117 years, on and off, now and then. A slap in the face, I say. No love between England and France, between England and Scotland, was created by this marriage. He married, I say, a French princess. Her name was Mary. A lot of Marys here. A lot of marrying, too. A lot of Marys. Soon, the king of Scotland, who had married this French princess, he is James the V, he dies. He has left a widow, the French princess, and a daughter, whose name is also Mary. We will eventually know her as Mary, Queen of Scots. Now, the French princess disdained the Scottish boorishness, looked down upon the Scots, did not want her delicate daughter to be reared a Scot, and wished her to be reared instead in French fashion and French morals and French design and French ways and customs. But she, the queen mother, the wife of the dead king, had to stand in for this child, daughter, who was technically now queen of the Scots, until she became of age and able herself to assume the responsibilities of government. In diapers, she was not fit for exercising royal authority. So the queen mother was a regent, and against her will had to stay in Edinburgh, reside in the palace, and nominally rule, though still the church was the powerful ruler. But Mary, the child queen, is reared in France, and she lives in the family of a French noble home. And she soon marries the heir to the French throne. His name is Francis. He is soon to become Francis II. She's still a teenager, and she has married him who is to be the king. He becomes the king, and he dies within months. He's king in 1559, and he's dead in 1560. And this Queen of Scotland is now a teenage widow at about the time her mother dies. The mother is the regent in Edinburgh in behalf of the Queen. And now she comes. Now, she is no friend of the Reformation. She knows little about it. She is soon to discover a great deal about it. She comes to Scotland. She comes to her homeland in which she has never lived. She comes to a people to whom she is an alien. And in her long absence, the Scottish nobility have drawn up a national covenant. These are the Covenanters, who have established the Reformation truth, the Reformed gospel, as the law of the land. And it was against the law, for example, to hold a Romanist mass in Scotland by the decree of a national covenant by the drawn up by the lords, the nobility, the leaders of the civil society of Scotland. Now we have a Catholic queen that has come to a country that has taken action against all she stands for. I am by this time pastor at St. Giles Church. I have come to my own land. The first day she is in residence in the Palace of the Holy Blood, Queen Mary, Queen of Scots, in her royal chapel in the palace, has her private priest perform a mass. The crown that represents the authority of law, higher than any other civil authority, has broken the law, has defied the law of the people. I enter my pulpit on the Lord's Day. My pulpit, as I stand before it, I face, I told you, the palace. I denounce not the Queen, I denounce the action of the Queen, and my people understand. I receive a summons on Monday to the palace, a royal summons. And this teenage sovereign employs all the weapons in the feminine arsenal to deal with this obstreperous preacher. She uses promises. She uses threats. She uses blandishments. She uses tears. She asks questions like, "Who are you in my kingdom?" And I reply, "Madam, I am a faithful subject and a profitable one withal." "What have you to do with my religion?" she says. "I believe my religion is true." "Madam, right religion demandeth knowledge, and of right knowledge I fear thou hast none." "Soon the people will be obeying you rather than me." "'Tis more important, madam, that both obey God." "Madam, I should return to my study." "You shall not long be in your study." "Madam, I fear I shall be longer in my study than you shall be on the throne." God was pleased to honor the testimony of the gospel. And it was compounded by her frivolous character. She was a widow before she was 20. She married a distant cousin, Lord Darnley, and was loved by him. And she dallied with the affections of an Italian male secretary. They were discovered by the husband who had been deceived and abused by this relationship. And in a fit of rage, he, the husband, the loving husband, ordered the death of the Italian male secretary. She proceeded to arrange a hunting lodge fire accident which took the life of her loving husband, and then proceeded within months to marry the nobleman, the Earl of Bothwell, who had been believed to be the one who arranged the death of her husband. She was about to marry Don Carlos of Spain, which would guarantee the continued Romanization of the Scottish throne. And this was too much for the people of Scotland. In my time, if you had an issue with the government, you did not write a letter to the editor of the local newspaper. Instead, what people did was create simple little ditties. You know them today as Mother Goose rhymes. Children repeated them in the streets. Their parents knew what they meant. The children did not. Some of you know some of them. A few of you are old enough to remember some of them. I fear the younger ones among you have not been reared on them. But one of them is very apropos here. Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet. Little Miss Muffet is Queen Mary of Scots. The tuffet is the throne of Scotland. Eating her curds and whey, going about her business, doing just what she wanted. Along came a spider. John Knox. Sat down beside, was summoned often to the throne room for consultations with the Queen. Sat down beside her and frightened Miss Muffet away. She was deposed by actions of the people. She was given her pink slip, walking papers, services no longer required. She left a son, a one-year-old son, who was to become King of Scotland, and at the death of Elizabeth, King of England. You know him as James VI, who reared a Protestant. As he came to London, was met by some Puritan leaders who presented him a millenary petition, which had nothing to do with ladies' hats, supposed to have had 1,000 signatures upon it, requesting certain changes by the crown authorized. Among them, and the only one that he assented to, was the development of a new and better translation of the scriptures into English. You know this as the authorized version of the Bible in 1611. The so-called King James Version, of which King James VI had little to do except to authorize and permit it. When she was deposed, the mother of James VI fled to England, hoping there to receive sanctuary. On the throne was Elizabeth, a fellow queen, a cousin. They had the same distant relative. Elizabeth's aunt was Mary's grandmother. And she, Mary, expected from a fellow queen to receive sympathy. But the very presence of Mary was a threat to Elizabeth's throne in England. Elizabeth had no sons, no daughters, no brothers, no sisters. She was the last of her line. And in the absence of Elizabeth, Mary, particularly while the infant son is an infant, he's not a threat to her yet. And it was a dilemma for Elizabeth to have Mary around. So Elizabeth gave her own palace and grounds. It was a most convenient form of house arrest. She had an entire palace and all of space she could desire. She had everything but liberty to leave. And Elizabeth waited. And implicated Mary eventually, whether rightly or not, we do not know, in a plot to overthrow Elizabeth and put herself on the throne of England. When this was found out, Elizabeth, reluctantly, but almost with a sigh of relief, we expect, agreed to have her executed. And she was executed by beheading because it was a treasonous act against the crown. She had struck at the head of the state, so her head was to be struck off. It is said, perhaps by tradition, that when the hour of execution arrived, Mary said of Elizabeth, not in her presence, Elizabeth did not attend the ceremony, dispatch me, but I leave a son, and you have none. And that last dig preceded the dropping of her head by the executioner's axe, which was preceded traditionally by the granting to the executioner by the victim of a bag of gold coins. This was the original tip to ensure promptness, telling the executioner, aim well, accomplish it in one clean blow. The alternative is not to be contemplated. Forgive me if that offends you, but that was the original tip. And it was designed to ensure promptness. What you are about to do, do it. Get it over with. And don't botch it. I had a late marriage after the death of my first wife. A marriage known by my friends as a marriage of May and October. I was October, and she was May, a young woman. We had daughters only. I had no sons. One of them did me so proudly. Years later, Welch was her name. Josiah Welch was her husband. He was imprisoned for refusing to take the authority of the Church of England as the basis of his right to preach. His command was from heaven, not from men. She, his wife, my daughter, went to the crown to request that his imprisonment be relocated closer to Scotland, where she lived, so that she could visit him more conveniently. She did not ask for his release. The king is supposed to reply, yes, I gladly will do so, on one condition, that your husband will accept the license from the Church of England. And I am so proud to tell you that she took the folds of her apron, raised it forward, created a space, and she said to the king, I would rather have his head here. She would not encourage him to betray his right conviction. That's noble. The years passed and my age descended and my time grew short. In 1572, I installed on a Sunday my successor in St. Giles' pulpit. Leaning on the arm of a friend, I walk the short distance from the church to my home on the high street. The streets were lined with a people's love. I entered that home, not again to emerge from it in this life. 8 days later was a Monday. Around noon, I asked my dear wife to read to me that resurrection chapter of the 1 Corinthians 15. About 6 o'clock in the evening, the family retired for family prayer. They returned after a few minutes and asked if I had heard them pray. And I feebly replied, "I heard sounds that you cannot know." At 11 in the evening, I asked for the reading of that 17th of John, where I first cast my anchor. And my man friend, servant, asked if I still held to what I had preached. I feebly raised three fingers and I said, "It is well with my body, with my soul, and with my spirit." And shortly before midnight, that ark in which I had sailed these many years cast anchor for the last time. And I went from this life to a far better. Today, in Scotland, there is no real adequate monument to John Knox. In the new town of Edinburgh, there is a tall, spire-like monolith, a monument that ends with a cupola in the top, in the midst of which is a more-than-life-size statue of Sir Walter Scott. The whole structure is more than six stories tall. If you look for a monument to John Knox, you find a small one, less than life size, behind St. Giles Church. If you look for his grave, you look in that parking lot under that right rear wheel. But Scotland is my monument. That phrase came to this teacher when he went through the papers of my mentor in graduate years, Dr. Brokenshire. He had studied over there and had written a postcard to a nephew. And he wrote it in such a large script that when he had finished writing it, there was no place to put the name and address to which it was to be sent. It never was mailed. It remained in his papers. And he said to his nephew, "There is no real monument to John Knox in Scotland, for Scotland is his monument." "May you," he said to his nephew, "become such a man." God be praised. A life was lived. A land was liberated. And your country, the United States of America, has known wonderful contribution from the Scottish and Irish people. More American presidents have been of Scotch-Irish lineage than of any other. God uses human agency to accomplish divine purpose. I said it as I began Friday night. I say it as I conclude this afternoon. He who could command angels to do his bidding invites men and women. We have the exalted privilege of taking up the cause and following the Master, the Savior, in the mission to give the gospel to the world of men. God help each of us God help you. God help me to be faithful servants of a gracious and sovereign God. Amen.